Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, when the store is quiet, I get to chat to my friends about the films and the series that we're loving. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop.
Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV?
Yells it.
Good morning, Russ.
Morning, Rusky.
How you guys doing?
All right, dude.
It's another mizzy day.
Yes.
God, I like it though.
I enjoy it.
Yeah, I'd much rather have this than a schwitzy 30 degree. Welcome to the video store. Thank you for wandering in. We've got all these lovely videos and games and good conversation here. We've got ourselves a G-Force.
Hello.
Who is an editor and a producer of this podcast. Mm-hmm. We've got ourselves a Gaddy.
Hey, hey.
Who makes candy.
I do.
Yeah, the Gaddles Candy Company. Yeah. And you are also standing alongside me on stage with the band Short Straw.
Yeah.
Which was delightful. We stood next to each other not too long ago.
Two nights ago.
Yeah, I'm still a bit tired.
Yeah, I did two shows that night.
Yeah, you did.
I was finished by the time I got home, yeah.
And my name is Russell. I am the owner of The Bioscope, mm-hmm. which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg. And when we're not doing all these lovely things, we're behind the counter talking about what we're watching.
Yep.
I've watched some good television.
Nice.
This last week. I want to talk about a limited series on Netflix that I think has been living in the shadow of the big things, the big juggernauts like Electric State, which I want us to touch on.
Right.
Yeah. But I think this one is a marvel. It's an absolute fucking marvel.
Okay.
So we're going to get into that. I want to talk to you, G-Force, about some cool stuff on YouTube.
Cool.
I know what you've been watching, which I think is cool. And yeah, what else? You've been watching Invincible, Gad?
Yeah, just season finale. It finished.
Is it done? Is it wrapped up?
Well, not the whole show. There's still going to be a season four.
But okay.
Yeah, season three is done.
Yeah.
And this is over on Amazon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. But before we get into it...
Mm.
I see we need to do some work here. We can't just talk shit behind the counter forever. here's a customer. One of us has to handle this.
Ari here returning The Ugly Stepsister, which we watched at the Berlin International Film Festival. This film is such a blast. There was a massive lineup of films, and this one really stood out to us. It's basically Cinderella meets The Substance, all from the ugly stepsister's perspective and the barbaric medieval styles of plastic surgery and essentially torture that she endured to be selected by the prince. The film is hilarious. It is disgusting. It is beautiful. It is erotic. And it's an incredible artistic achievement from a first-time director who's not used any CGI in this film. It's completely practical. And we liked it so much, we bought the African rights for the movie, and we can't wait for you guys to see it at the Bioscope.
All right.
Yeah.
Jeez, that sounds interesting.
Mm.
And, by all accounts, this sounds like a Bioscope film.
Nice.
So hopefully it'll come to the Bioscope in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah.
But I just love that. I've been to one or two of those festivals, and it's overwhelming. And so it's interesting to always see which ones stand out for someone.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, or maybe the video store can go to some film festival sometime.
Hey, that'd be lovely. We should do that.
Holiday.
No, you got to work, Gad. It's not a holiday. You're going to watch movies.
Sounds terrible.
We're going to get into it. We like to kick things off with a little rapid-fire entertainment news.
Yes.
Which we call, Hey, Did You Guys See? Mm. Who would like to kick it off?
Hey, I'll go. Hey. Nice. Hey, did you guys see that Tool's fans are suing Tool?
What?
Okay.
So they did this they played at this festival that was happening in South America.
Okay, so Tool is a rock band.
How would you describe their sound?
I mean,
sound?
They're in the genre of heavy rock, heavier rock.
Yeah.
But they are known, and I think this is important for people who don't know, they are known specifically to be like the musician's musician.
Yeah.
So it's very complex. Very intense. These are synonyms for pretentious, but that's up to you to decide. Okay,
so it's a band called Lux.
Yeah.
Yes. No, that's what I mean. It's like, it's all about like...
it's prog.
Yeah, prog. That's prog. A good...
Prog.
Which stands for progressive,
yeah.
Which is about...
It's very technical.
It's very technical, and it's all about
almost
time changes.
Mathematical.
Exactly. Okay, so...
So they played two nights at this three-day festival that they kind of organized.
Okay.
And they'd promised fans that it was going to be two unique sets. And I think a lot of people paid a lot of money to fly over for these shows specifically.
Right.
And there was quite a lot of overlap over the two sets. Like half of the songs from the first night they played on the second night, and people were not happy.
People are suing them. Jesus.
But Tool fans specifically.
My Lord.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
my Lord.
Wild.
Yeah. there are those bands. And I remember we had a night off when we were on tour in London. And of all the acts we could see,
yeah,
because we thought, hey, there's a whole world of possibility for us in our one night off. And the only thing that we could find happening was Dan Patlansky,
who's
a South African guitarist.
Yeah.
But he's a fucking incredible guitarist.
Yeah.
So we went to that show and we just realized his audience was all much older males that were all just in the audience quietly judging him. Just because they were like, you know, virtuoso guitarists themselves.
Could have been
virtuosos.
Me. Could have been me.
Yeah. No, I'm sure they were having a good time. And he's an incredible musician. But it was like, there was definitely this air of like, what you got? What you got?
That reminds me, I remember reading, I think it was on Reddit, of somebody describing what they imagine a dream theater show to be like.
Yeah.
Which is nothing but like 40-something-year-old dudes with their shirts tucked into their jeans, with their hands in their pockets.
Yeah.
And every time the time signature changes, they just nod furiously because they're excited.
With the little hair they have, they've got it tied back.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, did you guys see... Jeff Daniels is going to join season 3 of Shrinking.
Okay.
As Jason Segel's dad.
Cool.
So Shrinking is over on Apple TV Plus, and for me, it's magic.
I really need to see it.
Have you guys watched it?
Mm-mm. I started season 1. It's just too sad for me.
It started a little sad. Basically, the whole premise of it is that Jason Segel's this dad. And we enter his story as his wife has recently passed away in a tragic car accident, and he is not doing well.
Mm.
Psychologically, he's a mess. He's sort of dived into drugs and loose women,
right.
Women of the night. And it's all about his community and his friends and his family as he kind of comes to terms with it.
Okay.
It's got that... magical element to it, which I think is Brett Goldstein.
Mm-hmm.
Every show that this guy touches from a writing perspective just injects so much heart, so much love, so much warmth. And then he later appears in season 2. He comes
up. Does he come? Because he's Roy Kent from...
He's Roy Kent from Ted Lasso, for those who don't know.
Which is also coming back, actually.
Well, thank you. Spoiler alert. My follow-up to this is... because what I wanted to say is that I think Shrinking actually wrapped up very perfectly.
Okay.
The first part was about him, you know, building up his kind of community of people and family. And it's very much similar in a way to Scrubs and Cougar Town because it's the same showrunner.
Right.
And so they're really good at building these like kooky, lovable relationships amongst each other. Like great neighbor, great friend. Like these people's friends feel like that's the best friend you could ever have. Do you know what I mean? They've got these lovely like in jokes and these lovely like moments. Brett Goldstein then appears because I think it's very similar to how he appeared in Ted Lasso.
Right.
He was a writer till eventually it was like, no one else can do this except for you because you've written this character. So he wasn't meant to be Roy Kent in Ted Lasso, but he eventually was like, I can do this.
Right.
And so I wonder whether he was always intended to appear in Shrinking. Hmm. So sorry, the basic overarching premise of Shrinking is that Jason Segel is a psychologist.
Yes.
And so he does understand mental health, but his own mental health is fucked.
Okay.
And the practice is owned by Harrison Ford.
Mm.
So it's lovely, huge, big characters that we really come to love. And Brett Goldstein plays the guy who actually murdered his wife.
Oh.
The guy who actually was the driver of the other car.
Okay.
And it kind of wraps up really well.
Who murdered...
Jason Segel's
wife.
Okay. So there's like... Just when he thought he was getting to the bottom of it, like, here comes this guy, and he's got to really address these things that he's kind of put under the carpet, so to speak. Okay. But it wrapped up perfectly, so I'm not quite sure what we're going to get or what the point might have been to do a season three. Very similarly, over to, hey, did you guys see?
Yeah.
They are teasing a fourth season of Ted Lasso,
okay.
Which also is like, is this a money grab? Because it wrapped up so perfectly.
Okay.
A post popped up on X in my record. I don't even read my followers, just my recommended.
Yeah.
And it was Ted Lasso going, oh, hey, it's been a while. What's been going on here?
Right.
Yeah, there was a photograph of like a seat in the crowd. And you know how you've got numbers spray painted onto the seat?
Yeah.
And the seat said 4.
Okay.
And it's the blue seat, which you kind of know from the intro, and it said Ted Lasso. So it's like you know season 4 is coming.
Okay.
But it's like, these were such perfect little morsels of television.
Right.
It's what you always say, Graham, which is like you got no... You haven't learned.
Oh,
Americans
yes,
can't help themselves.
Yes.
Like the British just get it right with those like
yeah, very famously the best British shows you've ever heard of were these limited series.
Yeah.
Really. There was far less episodes of Mr. Bean than you remember.
There were only 3. No, there were like 12 or something.
There were 12, 8 or 9 or something, but that was it.
Yeah.
All right.
Hey, did you guys see we got a trailer for F1?
Yes.
We had a teaser a while ago.
Too, yeah.
But we now got a full trailer for it.
We now get some story.
Yes. It looks really good. I know it's just a big ad paid for by Formula One, but it looks really, really good.
Yeah, it feels like it's a story we know, which is maybe a good thing.
It feels very much like your kind of typical sports movie.
Yeah, which is that Brad Pitt is... sort of a person of some former glory who is being brought into the team.
Mm.
Very famously in Formula One, a team is 2 drivers who work together as a team but are also competing against each other in theory as in the drivers' championship.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like there's this young driver that he's got to sort of get in shape.
Yeah, I think it's a new team. That's the gist that I'm getting. It's a new team and they've brought him on as like the old experienced hand, and now there's like the young buck who he has to like help or like the young prodigy that he has to kind of help along.
So it's gonna hit cinemas in a couple of months later about September.
I can't remember. It might be August.
Yeah, but it's definitely a big tentpole.
Yeah.
It's one of the most expensive movies ever made.
Yes, it's like $300 million or something. It's Joseph Kosinski, who's the guy who did...
Top Gun Maverick,
Tron Legacy.
Okay, so the guy knows how to handle a big...
He's a good director.
...action movie. Lewis Hamilton has very famously been involved in all the minutiae of the movie to make sure that, you know, this wouldn't happen, this would happen, you would say this, you would do this.
Yeah, and they've been filming at race weekends.
Yes.
Like actual races.
And so anyone who has been following Formula One has seen that, you know, Brad Pitt's sort of gotten in a car and done laps before these Grand Prix have taken place.
Yeah. Was there something they've like developed new cameras or something to go on those cars?
Yeah, I know there's some like crazy cameras that like rotate around that are attached to the cars and that sort of thing.
Ooh.
Yeah,
it's going to look beautiful.
Yeah, it looks like what we see in the trailer looks phenomenal.
But speaking of Formula One in general, Drive to Survive, the new season is out.
Okay.
And folks are binging away at it, including me.
Cool.
I'm taking it in little morsels because when it has landed, I've just gobbled like the whole thing down.
Okay.
And then you kind of forget the details. But this later season of Drive to Survive has been good. I think it's one of those shows that itself is evolving and just becoming slicker and slicker.
Yeah.
Does it focus on a particular person each episode or something?
Yeah, so what they're doing is there's so many stories, and this is what I love, is that the first season was very much like the season, which is like, we started in Australia. Here's the story. at the Australian Grand Prix. Here's the story at the next one. Here's the... And then they realized, like, there is just way too much. But
right.
It is the most incredible and best sports docuseries. And it makes sense that this one was the first one and the best one, and that Netflix then commissioned every other sport thereafter, because there are only so many seats in Formula One. Where with tennis and golf, it's infinite. Sure, there's the guys near the top, but it's not like this, you're in or you're out.
Right.
There's only 22 seats, so you can only have 22 characters, in theory.
Is that how many people race at a time?
That's how many people are, I think it's 22, but it's literally around that number. But that's how many Formula One drivers there are. You either are one or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
Where with golf, it's like, I'm also a golfer. I'm about 15,000th or 30,000th in South Africa or something. There's like a when you got your ranking on your app,
yes.
you can see it's like I'm the 60,000th best in South Africa.
This might be an ignorant question. But is Formula 2 and Formula 3, do they exist as lower leagues?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And And so that's it. Formula One is the one. There is no better than that. That is what every race car driver dreams of, is to be one of those people. And of course, what I think is fascinating is you could be very talented, but if you're not the best and there is someone else busy having like an incredible reign, you just never stand the chance.
Yeah.
And so you are living your dream, but you can't be the best because perhaps... you're in the middle of Lewis Hamilton's 7-year-long reign.
Yeah.
Currently, we're seeing Max Verstappen being the sort of the main dog. Mm. And what happens is the winners keep winning because you keep that confidence. You keep that. You win money based on how well you do. So the richer get richer.
Yeah. Teams also matter a lot. Like it's not a case of like stuff like Indy and America and NASCAR. They all drive the exact same car.
Yes.
Whereas in Formula One, every team develops their own car.
Yeah, they have to stick to certain rules,
and
those are quite stringent and very particular.
But some teams just have way, like Ferrari has way more money than some of the smaller teams.
The guy who's currently winning, what does he drive?
It's Red Bull is the team, but Red Bull obviously don't make engines.
Yes.
So I think last I checked, Red Bull use a Honda engine.
Okay.
But you've got like McLaren, who are like, they're car makers. Like Mercedes is a car maker.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
So yeah, nice to see that the story is taking shape, and we'll just hope it's not shit.
Yes.
hey, did you guys see that Neil Blomkamp?
Oh yeah.
Is going to direct a new retelling, so it's not a sequel, of Starship Troopers.
What? Oh.
So Starship Troopers is a book.
Yes.
Which very famously became the sort of cult movie in the 90s that Paul Verhoeven did.
Yes.
But yeah.
That's interesting.
We'll write and direct a fresh adaptation of Robert A. Henlon's classic 1959 sci-fi novel.
Yes.
That's unlike curious. Paul Verhoeven's satirical 1997 film, this version aims to return to the original source material.
Okay, that's interesting.
It's amazing what a fine line satire is.
It'll focus on the novel's military society and deep sci-fi themes.
Because the original is kind of considered to be quite pro-fascist.
And that's maybe why not the movie... pro, but sort of pointing it out.
No, I think it's like quite in support of fascism, the book. Okay. That's why the point of the movie, like a big point that Verhoeven was making, was satirizing fascism. That was that's why a lot of people who are fans of the book don't like the movie.
Oh, because the book actually the movie criticizes the book.
In a way, yeah.
Interesting.
I'm curious to see how they tackle that.
I just remember Starship Troopers being like just the perfect movie for a high school boy when I was a high school boy.
It was amazing.
Because it was cool action, it was a fun comedy, and there was boobs.
Yeah.
There was a lot of boobs. Gary, you got any others? Okay, cool. Did you see that we also got a... did you guys see that we also got a teaser for Spinal Tap 2?
What?
Okay. I saw like a poster original cast.
I would only imagine.
Oh, God.
So for those who don't know, Spinal Tap, and Gad, I'm sure you know lots about Spinal Tap, was in many ways... at least for me, one of like the original mockumentaries.
Yeah. It was the first, yeah.
I think it was the first of its kind in many ways, where it followed this fictitious band.
Yes.
Called Spinal Tap, who were like a
Iron Maiden,
perhaps even
more
a
like
earlier.
Hair metal, Def Leppard.
Yeah, but not in the '80s. It was more like they were sort of like a '60s, '70s. Like
well, they kind of went through different phases, but yeah, that kind of Black Sabbath.
Yeah, like a Black Sabbath-y band, and the film is obviously set in the style of documentary.
Yeah,
where you know we've so used to it now with Parks and Rec. And The Office mm-hmm. and all this kind of documentary style and how we can acknowledge the camera, talk to the camera. But of course, it's all fictitious. And yeah. What I love as well is that Spinal Tap, the film, was following this famous band.
After their heyday.
Yeah, in the era where they're not as famous anymore. And there's lovely personal in-jokes. If you've watched the movie, the most famous of which is the guitarist pointing out that he's got these specially made amps that can go to 11. And there's a great moment where the voice of the documentary filmmaker says, well, why don't you just make a louder amp? He goes, no, but mine goes to 11, where all other Marshall amps go to 10. And of course, you realize the guy's a bit, you know, he's not the smartest.
Yeah.
There's also a lovely joke about Stonehenge, which was one of their albums or one of their songs. And
they wanted something like a set, the Stonehenge send made.
Yes.
And then it arrives and it's like...
It's tiny.
It's tiny because when they sent in the instructions, they confused the symbol for inches with meters.
Right.
And so they made it to size based on what they said. It's funny. And then there's another great moment in the movie where they are finally actually getting a good audience and they can hear them, but they get lost backstage trying to find the stage. So it's great. It's this lovable movie. It's totally worth your time at any point. It's timeless.
Yeah.
And I think what's cool is that we're going to get the sequel, which hopefully won't be shit.
Yeah.
Well, A Mighty Wind was almost like a sequel because it was the same band members, but they were in a folk rock band.
Oh, I don't know about that. A film called?
A Mighty Wind.
A Mighty Wind. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't know anything about that.
Let's check that out.
All right. Okay. Lacka, anyone got anything else?
No.
Okay. I'd love to chat to you guys about some films. Let's move on to films. The Bioscope just finished screening the Joburg Film Festival. They always get really great films.
Mm.
They really do curate that well.
Okay.
The fest sometimes struggles in marketing.
Right.
But, you know, every year we just hope they build on that. But the one thing you can certainly applaud them for is their film curation.
Nice.
The opening night film I want to chat about because it's a film that is going to come to the Bioscope at the end of this month, the end of March. And it is a film about a very famous South African photographer.
Well,
famous and not famous.
Right.
The film is called Ernest Cole, Lost and Found.
Okay.
And it's a lovely film, which I just want to tell you guys about. Ernest Cole is a black photographer that during apartheid was able to get this kind of incredible access, obviously being black.
Yeah.
Into some parts of society and create these incredible images.
Right.
He then found he needed to leave South Africa and went into exile and spent a lot of his life in the States,
right.
Where he then published a book called House of Bondage, which became, for the rest of the world, a very famous book about apartheid. And in many ways... exposed apartheid to the world.
Right.
Because they kind of needed these images to sort of really...
A photo book he published.
It's a photo book. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. It was banned in South Africa. So that's what I'm saying is that South Africans didn't really know Ernest Cole.
Right.
And then this film is quite something because thereafter you find a guy very displaced, very far away from his home, in many ways very much struggling with his own identity and struggling with himself, struggling to kind of produce work. But he shot a lot of photos just throughout his life, a lot of great street photography of New York, and he traveled to Sweden and he did these things. But it's an interesting portrait of a person because in the end, he he died sort of a nobody. He died like basically homeless.
Right.
But in many circles, was this published, celebrated artist.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point post his death, someone had access to these, or was looking after these film negatives and put them in a vault.
Right.
In Sweden. And it got like locked and put in this vault. Till eventually, I don't know, they must have been biding their time or seeing, but eventually word got to his family that there were these like 60,000 or like thousands and thousands of negatives that were in this vault.
Right.
But they couldn't reveal, and they didn't reveal who put them there, who paid for them to be there, but right. They eventually got released. And upon looking at these photos, they've made this film.
Okay.
And the filmmaker is a guy called Raoul Peck, who's also himself a very interesting filmmaker. He's done a lot of political films, political documentaries, one of the most famous of which was a film called I'm Not Your Negro, which was a film the Bioscope screened, which was right at the start of Black Lives Matter.
Mm.
It's pre-George Floyd. And when we were in COVID and the Bioscope was busy shut and moving to 44 Stanley, when George Floyd happened and that sort of fire got reignited, I remember thinking, "Oh, this would be a good time to screen I'm Not Your Negro." And then shortly after, or a few months later, we were able to open under level 3 lockdown.
Yes.
And so we brought it back. And I just thought that was so cool that the Bioscope can always be that cinema that'll bring these relevant documentaries back. And we got a chance to have him at opening night. Raoul Peck came out.
Cool.
He's of Haitian descent and actually served like in government in Haiti as a minister of culture.
Mm.
So a very smart dude. Nice. And what he did, which I think is a very interesting thing for filmmakers to understand and see, is that he tried to tell his story. He tried to tell the film as if he was Ernest Peck. So he had a voiceover sort of talk. And he got that from interviewing people, and he got that from notes, and he got that from all sorts of information. And it was just lovely hearing him talk about how he had to embody this other person.
Okay.
And also not get distracted in anecdotes or other people's sort of ideas of him. They had to root it in as much fact as possible so that you could watch this and go, okay, I feel like I'm listening to him talk.
Yes.
So it's a masterpiece in documentary.
Nice.
And it's also, fuck, we need some reminders about apartheid.
Yeah.
I know that there was definitely this feeling of like, I think you guys are all old enough. Gaddy, you my age, you nearly 40. G, how old are you?
38.
You're 38, not far behind. You know, we grew up where there was definitely a time where it's like, okay, we don't want to always have this shoved down our throat or brought up or, you know, be the topic of every conversation in South Africa. But now we need some reminders.
Yeah.
Also, just to explain like just how we got to some of the fucked up places we've gotten to as society. And it's because there were these things, and you were reminded of what it felt like. And I think every South African that's white also needs to hear this voice of what it felt like and what those passbooks meant. And you know, those people are alive today.
Yeah.
You know, like
it's recent history.
It's very recent. And you sort of see these couple of moments where it's like, okay, the new South Africa is happening. There's Nelson Mandela. There's the guy we know.
Yeah.
The guy holding the fucking microphone is Cyril.
Yes.
It's like, so it's like, let's not forget the compound interest of what all this meant.
Yeah.
And these folks are still, you know, working and sitting on boards and doing things and managing and approving stuff. And, you know, so it's a little bit like the Zapiro documentary. It's like, let's not forget the Jacob Zuma era.
Yeah.
So I think it's a valuable thing. I think from a storytelling perspective, it's a solid documentary.
Cool.
So it's called Ernest Cole, Lost and Found, and it's coming to the Bioscope at the end of the month. So it's a perfect Bioscope film. So yeah.
Nice.
I'm excited to It feels like it's fertilizer.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? Like sometimes there's the popcorn-y films and yes. It's, let's just have a lot of fun and oh my God, it's a cool horror. Or, you know, here's a big bold swing.
Yes.
But this feels like fertilizer. It feels like cultural fertilizer.
Okay, nice.
So it's important to me.
Cool.
Then we've also got Black Bag coming.
Oh, yeah. I've read very good reviews for it.
It's a smart film. Gary, nice. Do you know about Black Bag?
No. Is that also a documentary?
No. So it is the new Steven Soderbergh film with Kate Blanchett and Michael Fassbender.
I saw it on the list for the...
It's an interesting movie. Yeah. Mm. It's in our sort of now, 2024, and they are both working for sort of British intelligence. They are both sort of agents, secret agents in a way. And... Those are always preposterous. And I must say, I kind of hate the fucking assassin movie.
Right.
I hate the spy movie to some large degree.
Okay.
I think we can all agree, like, Tom Cruise is good and we've built up Mission Impossible.
Yes.
Let's continue that.
Well, I've just binged Archer, and that's like a satire of all those spy things.
But that's a fun cartoon.
You can't take them seriously after watching that.
Personally, I'm getting a bit tired of, like, I'm secretly an assassin. It's like such a Netflix movie.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like, oh, you didn't know it, but I'm actually an assassin. It's like, fuck me, I'm tired of that shit. But this is in that world, but without the sounding like a criticism, this is one of those action intrigue thriller movies without actually any action.
Okay.
It's all in these like intense, smart scenes. So basically, there's a situation, there's a mission, there's a mole, there's a threat. And Fassbender is having to look into another agent, and that other agent could be his wife.
Okay.
Kate Blanchett and Michael Fassbender are husband and wife. They both work for British intelligence, and they are having to interrogate each other.
But they both know they work for British intelligence.
They both know that.
Okay.
But there's points where it's like they know each other well enough to know that he might be still spying on me, but he shouldn't be because he should respect me because he knows he could trust me, but now he's doubting himself. And it's a very smart, very complicated, but very smart movie.
Right.
Soderbergh's brilliant. I mean, he's very concise with his filmmaking.
He's also an interesting filmmaker in the fact that he's never put up his hand to say, I have one style.
Yes.
You know, when he did the Oceans films.
Yeah.
You know, and those were a particular kind of heist look films. And then he can do something else. So he's never delivered on like a particular style, but he's kept a really great reputation for himself.
Mm. Wasn't he supposed to be retiring? Didn't he say he wasn't going to be making movies anymore? I'm sure.
But this movie's also got a very interesting look in that their choice of lens was interesting.
Okay.
There's like a glow to the film. So when and they've certainly leaned in because there's like these dinner party scenes where they all have candles. But they've done it in this kind of like really like glowy look.
Hmm.
So the movie's got this, it's got, like, I don't know, there's no other word to describe it other than sort of like glow, almost like video as opposed to film.
Right.
But.
Steven Soderbergh was the cinematographer.
Okay. So he obviously
shot his own film.
He was particularly like looking for a very particular film. But
yeah.
In the sense that there obviously are, there's one or two sort of big, relatively big budget scenes, but for the most part it's quite a small film.
Okay.
You know, a lot of it takes place at like a dinner party and afterwards and in the offices, and so it's unique in the sense that it's all very cerebral. Okay. It's not this like
it's reliant on its
go
writing.
And fucking shoot everybody up. Yeah, very reliant on its writing. Okay. You could perhaps criticize it for being a bit too smart.
Right.
But I think that's up to the viewer to decide.
Right.
All right. So yeah, Black Bag.
Cool.
Yeah. And you'll see the name reference when you watch the movie. You'll understand.
Okay. And it's at the Bioscope.
It's going to be at the Bioscope.
Nice.
Yeah, from this weekend.
Nice.
All right. Should we talk some TV?
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Obviously the big one, the biggie, is Electric State.
Oh, right.
Which is this is Russo Brothers?
Yes.
The guys behind the big Avengers stuff.
Yeah.
And Arrested Development.
Yeah, that's right.
They directed the pilots and developed the show.
Oh, that's cool. Hmm. Well, that's redeeming of them.
That's how they got the job to do, I think, Civil War. Was that their first movie?
One of the Captain Americas was their third, first one.
Second or the third one.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Arrested Development is obviously very different from a big Marvel movie.
Yeah.
But these guys clearly know how to handle a big one. And this is the big Netflix movie that has been teased for a while. It's got all the tent poles and all the big stars of the day. In that it's got Chris Pratt, kind of just being Chris Pratt. It's the same as Ryan Reynolds. They don't stretch their their acting much. They are lovable characters we've all come to know. And we've got Millie Bobby Brown, who we've watched grow up through Stranger Things.
Right. Who that is? I didn't watch Stranger Things.
She was 11 in Stranger Things, and we've just watched this now woman grow up. She's married to Bon Jovi's son in real life. Bon Jovi.
Okay.
And Giancarlo Esposito's in this.
Who we know from Breaking Bad.
So hammy in this movie.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So I have to admit, I haven't finished it.
Yeah.
There was a lot that I consumed and had to do this weekend, including play a show with Gad. So, but I got into it. It's an odd movie, Graham. We're in the 90s.
Okay.
And we're in the 90s, we're in this kind of...
alternate universe.
It's somewhat of an alternate universe, although it's not literally that. It's we invented robots, and at some point...
It goes back to the 50s that robots became developed, and they developed them alongside... So it's so interesting. You got this VHS and computer technology alongside the super sophisticated robot technology.
So at some point, the robots got fucking smart. They got like sentient, and they don't quite explain that. But it's just like the robots sort of.
There's an uprising.
They became sort of unionized,
right?
By Mr. Peanut, the one robot,
right?
But it was like, you know, I guess that sort of 1950s vision of the future. We're all going to have robots that are going to help us clean our house and shit like that. And in a way, we did. But the furthest we've really got in real life is like a Roomba, you know, that like just knows where its base is and it kind of gets to map your house. That's as smart as we really got.
Yeah.
But in this version, they got fucking so smart that they unionized and started a war. And the only way to like actually beat these robots in this war was to create a sort of a helmet that you could wear as a human that could control a robot so that the robots could actually fight robots. Right. Because the humans were dying against the robots.
So the robots weren't sentient. Smart. They were literally only controlled by humans.
Right.
And so in a mech suit almost.
These ones. The humans invented this. They invented this kind of avatar that you could be. And they won the war and put all the robots in this exclusion zone.
In the desert. In the south.
In the middle of fucking nowhere. As a result of this technology, you can now be a human that could just chill on your couch, put on these things, and you could be somewhere else, and you could do other things. And so these robots can also run around the world. But they're at least controlled by you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of the world building. That's where we start. Millie Bobby Brown's got a very smart brother.
Right.
And we find out that she is now this kind of foster kid because her parents and her brother died in a car accident.
Okay.
And then she's living in this kind of foster home, and then it comes out that a robot has broken out of the exclusion zone and has now found Millie Bobby Brown, and it turns out it could be her brother.
Oh.
Working through this robot.
Yes.
And she then encounters Chris Pratt, who is a sort of trader. He trades stuff out of the exclusion zone to the rest of the world, selling these parts, and then... I don't want to give too much away, but now we're on this adventure to find the brother.
Okay.
But the brother also then is important and holds this kind of key.
Yeah, it's...
it's a little bit complicated, but...
The graphics are interesting.
It's an interesting look. And I must say, there are these points where you're like, it's cool to see this level of CGI.
Yes.
It's very glossy.
It's got a glossiness to it. Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, it's an interesting swing. I don't think it's
harmless.
Yeah, it's harmless.
Right.
But over on Netflix on the same weekend, Adolescence comes out.
Okay.
And Adolescence is the show I really want to talk about. Can we get into that, or do you guys want to talk about anything else?
No,
Electric State. Okay. Adolescence is a British limited series. Okay, it's 4 episodes.
Okay.
And first episode starts with this police operation that's outside this house.
Right.
They bust into this house early in the morning and they arrest this 13-year-old boy, literally out of his bed. And they arrest him on suspicion of murder because another 13-year-old has been murdered, a girl. Right. This first episode follows them into the house, arresting the kid in the car, into the station, and there's this moment where this kid's like fucking... He's a little kid. He's a little kid, and this whole big police operation has taken him, and he's now in the station, and you're in the bowels of the station as he's being checked in.
Right.
And so the whole show is about this boy.
Right.
And the family and the detectives around whether or not he murdered this kid, this other girl in his school. Here's the clincher.
Yes.
Here's the fucking thing, the big thing. And I purposefully didn't tell Leslie, my wife,
right,
what was happening until we were at the end of episode 2. Okay. I said, did you notice? Have you noticed what this movie, what this show is doing that is completely unique to anything else?
Yeah.
She's like, no, I didn't. And what? It is one single take. Without any gimmicks. Without any filming technique. So we've seen 1917. We've seen a few of these where it's a long take. Mm. And that's been its thing. But there's been these moments where perhaps the character like closes their eyes. Or perhaps there's a... where they
goes behind a wall.
Where they go behind a wall. And it's so seamless you don't even notice. But they actually have these cuts.
So this is one...
This is one... No gimmick. Okay. No transitions. Nothing. And so as a result of that... It is this masterclass in acting.
Right.
Because we've said this before, each medium that we have in culture celebrates different aspects of the creative process.
Yes.
A film is very much the director's medium, which is what do you get out of the actors? How do you cut it? What's the mood? What are your decisions? Television is very much the writer's medium.
Yeah.
You hear about the writers doing these dress rehearsals and changing the jokes. SNL, for example, is perfect writer's medium. It's all about pitching the idea. Theater is the actor's medium because you can direct the fuck out of it, but what happens on that stage when that actor gets up is entirely up to the actor. And that's kind of what happened. They had to rehearse the crap out of these
and it's a kid
sequences. This kid is such an incredible actor.
Oh, gosh.
One of the episodes is just him and a psychologist as it follows, you know, the day of the arrest.
Yes.
3 days later, a couple other months later, as this kid is embroiled in this situation.
Right.
You know, there's one episode that's just him and the psychologist, and it's this camera just like moves around them in very careful ways as they reveal themselves, and you're wondering this whole time, has this kid done it and all these things, but it's just such an incredible way of showing the process.
Yes.
You know, and showing how the booking works and how, you know, you got to go there. Now you got to do this. Now this person's got to assess him. Now this, who's going to be the appropriate adult?
Did you finish it?
With him? Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It's easy enough to finish. There's parts of it that are quite grueling, but it's in a very, what I was saying to Les is like, it's quite easy to watch because we're quite used to life playing out real time.
Yes.
Because it fucking plays out real time in front of us all the time. So we're quite used to the passing of an hour.
Yes.
We can watch this. It's not boring, at least because they've coordinated these scenes. It is a fucking smart show.
Cool.
And it is very, very, very much worth your time.
Nice.
The dad is a person that you will recognize. He's a British actor called Stephen Graham, who was in Snatch.
Right.
He was one of the guys standing next to Jason Statham that said, you know, oh, you waiting for the British to come? Or what is that line?
I don't remember.
The Germans. The Germans. Are you waiting for the Germans? You'll recognize him. He's obviously now a lot older.
Yes.
But, you know, there are these points where I think it's so interesting from a writing and storytelling to say, well, if you've got these moments, if the point of your show is to pick 4 hour-long moments in the story,
yeah,
what are you going to show?
Right.
You know, and one would be like, you would think it would be obvious, let's do the trial. But you don't. And so the question is like, how do we reveal our story, enough story in this concept, which is like you've actually got this real-time hour. Very good. Cool. Adolescence. It's on Netflix. And I think, you know, Electric State was the big one. But here were these like smaller little ones that
they spend $300 million. They want people to watch it.
Exactly. I think it might be the most expensive Netflix film.
I mean, it's up there. But no one's talking about it. That's the thing that I'm like, maybe this wasn't. But like none of the stuff that the Russos have done post-Avengers has been well received.
Yeah.
Like nothing.
Yeah, and you also realize that our, you know, Avengers just had so much written for them.
Yeah.
You know, the Infinity Stone saga had been written. Sure, you make these maybe different decisions from the comics. But like the world was just so established, you just had to execute.
Yeah.
And that's what I find very interesting is that, you know, someone like John Krasinski is praised for Quiet Place. Someone else fucking came up with that idea. He just executed it.
Yes.
He acted and directed it. But the concept were those other bros.
Right.
You know, and then when you give him his own property, which is If, it's quite a shit movie.
Oh, right.
Yeah, not great.
You know, like, he was a really good actor. And so when there was good comic writing in The Office, he shone.
Yes.
I'm certainly not saying he's not talented.
Yeah.
But it's like, don't give him too much credit. It's the same with the Russos. It's like, you helmed what was at one brief window the most profitable or the highest grossing film of all time.
Yeah.
It's like, because 20 fucking films built you to that point.
Yeah.
So it might not be entirely all you're doing.
Yeah.
They're getting paid a fortune to do the two new ones.
Yeah.
And it's them, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they've also got the source material.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. What are you guys enjoying?
Invincible.
Cool.
Okay. Let's talk about Invincible.
Yeah. So season 3 just wrapped up. Invincible's a story about Mark.
It's a comic.
It's based on a comic. Yeah. Robert Kirkman, who did Walking Dead, created Invincible.
And it's an animated TV show.
Yeah.
It's
on Amazon, on Prime.
Yeah.
So similar to The Boys, it's quite gruesome and graphic. But it makes The Boys look like a Disney movie. It's just even more.
I guess you can do that with animation.
You can draw anything.
Yeah.
It's just like you can see how very fragile the human body is on the show.
Why do you enjoy it, Gad?
I just like the idea of the inverted idea of Superman, this alien that comes to Earth to protect it. But the whole premise of Invincible is it gets revealed that instead of protecting the Earth, he's there to prepare it for an invasion of his planet. And it's this kind of turnaround because his son, who's just developed superpowers, is not having anything of that. And then they have a fight and then he leaves and that's the end of season one. And then the rest of it is just dealing with this fallout, this fight that they had totally destroyed cities. And the Earth is learning to accept Invincible as a superhero, and it's just he's dealing with what he did and the Earth is still dealing with him, and it's just these amazing emotions that come through. And it's just incredible. And in this new season it gets revealed that his father had another child with another alien on another planet. And he comes back to live with Mark's mother, and this other alien is a very fast aging species, so his brother is like aging really quickly.
Okay.
And he's got superpowers and he's maturing like really quickly and wants to help his brother. And
But an invasion is coming.
Yeah. So the Vultramites, his father's race, are coming to invade the Earth, and they are the strongest beings on like the world has ever seen. And just violent. They will just want to destroy. The finale is just one of the most gruesome things I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, wow.
It is just so hectic. Oh,
okay. But funny?
Yeah, it's like very clever, dark humor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very aware of itself and doesn't take itself too seriously.
Okay.
But like, your characters are intense and love it.
It's a good show.
Okay. You've also been watching, huh?
Yeah, I'm only like 3 episodes in. They're like almost hour-long episodes, yeah, which is unusual for an animated show.
Yeah, that is unusual.
Yeah, they're usually like 25 minutes, but these are like 40, 50 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's good though.
Lovely, man. What have you been enjoying, G-Force?
Oh, Lord, almost nothing. I hardly watch anything these days.
Would you say you've been watching a lot of Taskmaster?
Oh, yes. Because, I think it was in 2020 when lockdowns were happening. They started uploading Taskmaster to YouTube.
This is a British reality TV show.
Yeah, sort of reality
TV show. It's like a game show.
It's more of a game show, but the contestants all British comedians.
It's a panel show.
Yeah, it's all like a lot of the people you'll see on like the British panel shows.
Okay.
So they're all British comedians who are participating in this.
Okay, and what's the premise?
Each season is 5 different comedians, and they're given over a series of weeks, they're just given a series of ridiculous tasks to do.
Okay.
And then Greg Davies. Oh my Lord, they vary so much. Sometimes there's like a house where most of them happen. Sometimes they arrive at the house and like, here's a boulder. Move this boulder as far away from the house as you possibly can in the next hour.
Okay.
They each get a boulder.
Yes.
Okay.
But they're typically all doing them like individually. And then sometimes there's group tasks as well, where they do stuff like one person will be blindfolded. Another person can see and they have to guide that person from one spot to another, but they can only speak every 30 seconds and they're only allowed to say 2 words at a time. It's like that sort of thing. And they're really like finicky with rules and that sort of thing.
Oh, I really love Greg Davies.
Oh, he's incredible, dude. He's so funny.
So he's the sort of main taskmaster.
He's the taskmaster.
Yeah.
So he's the one who like dishes out the points and everything.
They're all on YouTube.
Yeah. They've uploaded all 18 seasons to YouTube.
What?
Yeah.
Greg Davies, for those who don't know, he's the very tall British comedian who was a school teacher for many sort of formative years of his life.
Yes.
He then went on to be a comedian, stand-up comedian, mm-hmm. but be in television.
Yeah.
Where he did play a school teacher.
Yeah,
in
he
a
did
TV
a show where he played it. I can't remember what the show
I think
was
it's
called.
The In-Betweeners. In-Betweeners. Okay. Or something like that, I think. I forget.
That was a great show.
But yeah, his stand-up is great. He's definitely very worth funny. A watch. I want to end on one thing.
Yeah.
Oh my God. There's a movie. Gad, is there any way that on your phone you can pick up what the top 10 is in Netflix? The top 10 movies?
I've got the app here.
Okay, just check what the top 10 is. Okay, right. There's this movie that Les found called The Forge.
Okay.
Okay, because it's been sitting in the top 10 for a while.
Right.
And upon looking, it looked like a very like made-for-TV, inspirational, heartwarming...
Hallmark-y
movie.
Okay.
So we start it, and we've got ourselves... Okay, so is The Forge in the top 10 of movies at the moment?
The Forge, yeah.
What number is it?
Number 3.
Wild. Okay. Wild. So here's this movie chilling in the top 3.
Yeah.
Podium. If we can go back to...
Faith and spirituality.
There we go. Okay. There we go. Okay, you see, I didn't get that part yet. We just thought Hallmark movie.
Yes.
What I find interesting is that this movie is as popular as it is.
Okay.
Okay, I find it interesting that it is number 3. Okay, that's the point. I'm not telling you to go out and watch this movie. I'm finding it interesting that a movie like this is sitting in number 3.
And is that ranking in South Africa?
This is the South African Netflix. The other thing that's interesting is that we are given a Hallmarky family drama movie,
mm-hmm.
but it's a black story. It's a black household, black male lead. Everyone in the film is black, which I think is interesting because when you think of the Hallmark family drama movie,
yes.
you know that real American. Single mom, young boy, trying to find his way in life. Like, it just, when you close your eyes, it feels white.
Yes.
It just, in my head, it just feels white. A Hallmark movie just feels like a bunch of white folk. That's why it's interesting when, in Christmas, there were a couple of those Christmas romance movies, but once you got in, you're like, oh my God, this is a gay movie. This is a queer film.
Yeah.
And there's this point where you're like, it's not a queer film because it's just about love.
Yes.
You know, I remember there was one year where Netflix released that, where it was like, surprise, this is a queer movie. And you just totally root for the person.
Yeah.
Because at no point is any part of that considered bad, right? Because that's always been the metrics. Young boy who loves to play basketball. And he's like just finished high school. He should get a job, but his like room's messy.
Right.
You know, so it's like he's a rebel. And he like goes into like a coffee shop and like chats up the girl, but the dad, you know, kicks him out because he's not going to buy coffee, and he's just trying to, you know, chaff this woman. So, you know, he's but sexist.
Right.
But the mom's like, you really need to get a job. So he like goes to this, he walks into this like fitness, it's like a shop that sells like gym shit.
Okay.
But it's like, it's a warehouse. So they like, they ship out to people like gym equipment. And the owner sort of is willing to kind of take a chance on him. But he's, you know, he's the kind of guy who like sleeps late. Or he's the kind of guy that like wants to play basketball with his friends.
Yeah.
And then when you know, when you pause the movie on Netflix, the name comes up.
Yes.
Right? In the sort of holding slide. And it says The Forge, and it's written in this kind of font that's very similar to the kind of sports movie, inspirational movie.
Right.
It's that sort of serifed. So it's like serifed font. You'll recognize it as being the you know, the title of many movies. But over the O is this like ray of light.
Right.
That's coming out over the O. And Les looks at that and she goes, what do you think's up with the light that's coming out over the O? She's like, "What, you know, what is this movie going to be about?" I was like, I think that's Jesus. I think that's God coming, because I saw one of the production companies behind it had like a sword in it.
Okay,
and I was like, okay, what are we in for? And now I've mentioned this before, and I've used the expression like you get prodded with the God stick.
Right,
you remember me saying this, where it's like it's a Christian movie,
yeah,
but they don't want to lay it in too thick.
Right.
Gad, remember you and I went and watched that one Angel Studios breakout hit, which was the human trafficking film.
Yeah.
Because we were quite interested in it. Because
is this an Angel Films?
It's not an Angel Studios, because that's obvious. When you see Angel Studios, you're like, okay.
Yes.
Christianity is involved. Sound of
Silence?
That's the Simon and Garfunkel song. What was that movie called?
I don't remember. It was
Sound of Something.
Sort of a hit.
Yeah. And I use that expression that, you know, they want to get a Christian agenda across in this movie. So every now and again, you know, you get this like little prod in your hips, you know. This movie, instead of being prodded with the God stick, it's a little bit like that scene when you're introduced to the bear Jew in Inglourious Bastards, where you hear the clanging of the baseball bat, and then he appears and comes, and he's ready to sort of fuck up the Germans. This movie just assaults you.
Right.
Assaults you with the fucking the
Sound
Lord.
Sound of Freedom.
Sound of Freedom. That's what it was called. And the, you know, this little kid, he turns his life around because he gets this mentor, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all for good people being good to each other.
Yeah.
You know, the golden rule. Treat each other how you should be treated.
Yeah.
But no, this movie batters you with the Lord. He eventually gets brought into this kind of group of men called the Forge, and they sort of, it's very cult-like. And you can see how dangerously close we are to a cult at this point, but it's all for the good. And then I sort of, there was this point where it was like, what could be the crisis? What could be the second act crisis? And you think it could be him like sort of faltering off the rails as he has, you know, he's been so good at getting his life together.
Yeah.
But no, it's not that exciting. They have to fulfill an order, crazy order, which would turn the company around and save the company.
Okay.
And it's like, guys, we can do it. Jesus, it's a cheese form.
It sounds like it knows its audience.
It knows its audience, and it delivers.
Yes.
And with lots of love and respect, you know, if you are Christian, then this is a movie for you.
Yeah. It sounds like it knows its audience and you're not its audience.
And I'm not its audience. I must say, I'm not an atheist. And this brought up a conversation again between myself and Les, who she is Christian and she is raised Christian. And I feel like I am too.
Yeah.
But I don't like the sort of by the bookness of it. Mm. To me, Christianity, like we were in Finland on an exchange program, and especially in the summer, which we got to experience Finland in, I'm sure it's quite depressing in winter, but this beautiful strong light would come in through the forests,
right?
And these beautiful Scandinavian forests with this strong, beautiful kind of summer light. And you realize that early Finnish people, before the sort of Christians came and the Vikings and all that shit, they worshipped the trees. Trees were, they were holy, you know, God was in the trees.
Yes.
And I was like, I see that. To me, that's that. God's there. God's in the sunshine and in the goodness and in the way we talk to each other. That to me is where that lives. And it's not in this kind of by the book stuff.
Yeah.
So I struggle when that gets put at you.
That American evangelical Christianity is
when you hear the word worship, you know, when you're in that room, when you're in that church, it's normal. It's a very normal word. But when you like step back slightly from it, you're like, it's a weird word, you know, to worship someone.
Yeah.
It's like, that's actually not like a good, healthy thing. Mm. Anyway, so I endured through the forge, but I just find it interesting that it's in the top three.
Yeah,
it once again reminds you how important and you know.
No, it makes sense. I mean, you say it's black actors. It's a big market in this country.
Yeah, exactly. That to me is more interesting. I'm not telling you to go and watch it. It's one of those, like, if it was just in the depths of Netflix and we found it by chance, it's like sure, but it's in the top three. Interesting.
Fascinating.
Okay.
Yeah.
So The Forge. If you need a little affirming of Jesus, it's there. It's there for you.
It's not a medieval movie.
No. All right. Lekker, guys.
Nice.
Thanks for the chat.
Yeah.
Thanks for the little hang. Thanks for working.
Yeah.
Sure.
And we'll see you guys again next week.
Yes.
Yeah, check you later.
All right. So our home base is thevideostore.co.za. We've got links to some guest episodes, but we've also got all the social media. Chime in. Let us know what you think of films like Electric State, or if you've seen Adolescence, or if you did see The Forge.
Yeah.
And what you think of it, let us know.
Yeah.
And we'll see you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Tally-ho.
Ooh, tally-ho. That's different.